You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Zara Phillips joins us now. She is an actor, playwright, an author, and a musician. Her most recent album is called Meditation and Kit Kats, and I've been listening to it nonstop. Zara Phillips is also an adoptee advocate and has written an extraordinary memoir called Somebody's Daughter. Zara Phillips, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
I really loved your book, and I now know everything about you. And so I wonder, you know, is it strange for you to have a book out there that is so, I mean, it's a very honest, and not just honest, but detailed. So, I mean, people know things about you that, you know, I mean, if you hadn't written that memoir, they wouldn't know those things about you. So, I mean, is that a strange thing?
It's strange, yeah, because you sort of forget, and then people, you know, say, oh, I know this or that. They remind you of things. But at other people's memoirs, that's what always has got me, is the honesty and the detail. And that's the part that I can relate with the most. So I suppose in a way, I've always felt like the only way to do this sort of work, or if you want to get across, you know, the truth of an experience, is you do have to sort of take that risk.
And when you were writing the book, did you think to yourself, oh, I can't say this, or I shouldn't?
Well, I did. You know, to be honest with you, I've written a few books around being adopted. And my first book was less detail, you know, more about some, I mean, some detail, but that's because my mum was alive. And I remember somebody saying to me, you cannot write as if your mother is reading over your shoulder. Like, you just can't do it. And I think when my mum died, because it was such a complicated relationship around the adoption, then my adopted mother I'm talking about, that it somehow freed me up. And I realized also that I had tried to make so many people happy for so long, by not being honest, by hiding things, that I thought, you know what, it's enough. Like, I need to share my experience, because my focus is on helping other adoptees that I know go through the same thing.
Well, let's get into that. When did you know you were adopted? Was that something you always knew?
I always knew, because I had a book, which actually is quite funny, because a lot of adoptees in England, I know, we all had the same book, and it's like the worst book. My kids, I read it to my kids years ago, and they're like, your parent, you know, your mother read you this book. You know, back in the 60s, it was just the most dreadful book of this family saying, you know, we don't know what's wrong, something's missing. And then they get a dog and a cat and this and that. And then they realize they want a baby. But the first baby that they see is sad. And the mother says, we'll wait for another baby. Oh. Seriously, you're going to read this to an adopted child? We don't. And I remember as a kid saying to my mum, what happened to that baby? I mean, it was a little cartoon drawing, but I was like, what happened to that baby? And she said, oh, someone else would have taken it. But, you know, it's just too sensitive. It's way too sensitive.
That's terrible.
No, it's terrible.
So they read you this book, and this was how they talked to you about being adopted?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was something you grew up
knowing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up knowing you're adopted, but if you ever do anything, it would devastate us.
Like, don't be sad, because if you're sad, then we would rather have a different baby.
Yes. Well, and also my mum was, you know, it would really hurt me. In one breath, she'd say, if you ever want to know anything, you can talk to me. And I'd say, oh, can I? And then she'd say, but you know, it would devastate me. All in one sentence. you learn very early on as an adoptee to protect your adopted parents. And it's a loyalty issue, and it's a survival issue, a feeling of survival. You know.
Now, you talk about your brother who kind of bullied you he definitely bullied you when you were a kid. What, was he there adopted as well?
He was adopted too, yes. So he was 2 years older than me. Again, very common. You'll see in a lot of adoptive families, they get the boy and then a couple of nice space in between. And then they get the girl. You know, it's quite, again, a lot of my friends were all, you know, the brothers and the daughters. So we weren't related biologically.
And do you still have a relationship with him?
Not really. Yeah. I choose not to. Very, very distant. I'll check in just to see sometimes if he's alive, to be honest. You know, it's not healthy for me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, he wasn't very nice to you, as people who read your book, Somebody's Daughter, will know. So when did you decide that you wanted to search for your birth parents?
Well, I think I always knew from when I was little that, you know, I was like the born searcher. Some adoptees are different. They tell you they're fine. They never want to know. And then some life experience happens in later life. Often when adoptees become parents themselves, and that can start. For me, it was almost like I knew I had to know because I couldn't really move forward, especially. And then when it got to my early 20s, as I talk about in the book, it was a driving force. So, you know, I just knew I had to do it regardless. And I was terrified because you don't know what your story is. You know, you really have no clue. Back in those days, they tell you nothing. So you don't know what you're going to find. But I just knew that for me to really feel, you know, that I could move forward in life, I had to.
Now, I don't want to, you know, spoil anything from your book, but you do you do find your birth mother in the book. And how did that affect your relationship with your adopted mother? Well, was she devastated like she said she would be?
Well, I didn't tell her for 2 years because I was very worried about it. And then finally I did. And our relationship, you know, it didn't change. And something, you know, I've done a lot of talks to adopted parents. And something I always want them to know is, I know it's really hard for adopted parents when we go searching, but it's nothing to do with us not loving our parents. It's nothing to do with that. It's just something we have to take this journey. And the crazy thing is, and it's not just me, I've heard many other adoptees say, once we find and know our stories, we can then feel more connected to our adopted family. But the not knowing, for me, like, I felt very disconnected. And so it's very true. Once I knew, I was like, okay, this is her. And now I can feel. So that's why it's so important in a way for adopted parents not to feel afraid, because actually your mother is your mother. You know, my mum's the one that raised me. My birth mother could never replace that. I was an adult. So she's never going to be able to replace those years. But yet she was still, I have two mothers. That's the reality.
So it really strengthened your relationship with your adopted mother.
You know, my adopted mother was rather complicated. So she wasn't easy. We didn't have an easy relationship. But I think what happened was I was able to be more accepting of her and understand the more I delved into the adoption and did my own work, my own therapy around it. I joined groups. I met other adoptees. I was able to understand her more. So yes, you know, I mean, it got to the best it could get with somebody like my mom.
Well, I think everyone's relationship with their parents can be complex, whether they're adopted or not. I know generalizations are difficult, but do you find that adopted parents will sometimes be more careful with their adopted children out of, I'm trying to word this properly, that maybe out of fear that because they're not their real parents, their children will reject them?
Absolutely. You nailed it, really. I mean, the thing is, you know, my brother really has had issues in his life. Me too. But for some reason, I've managed to go and seek the help I needed. Him, not so much. And I know many other adoptees with the same with the boy. For some reason, the males have a really hard time. And the adoptive parents behave the same around it, because I think, and I, as I say, I've done a lot of talks over the years with adoptive parents, and they do feel responsible almost. They feel like somehow it's their fault. And again, what, you know, something that we always end up talking about is, in a way, it's nobody's fault. It's just what adoption is. But everybody's lied to about adoption. You know, the adoptive parents have no clue when they go in. Even the most enlightened adopted parents don't really get it until their kids. And it's always, I was talking to somebody yesterday, as their child gets to like, you know, 12, 13, which is hard for any child, the stuff starts happening. And a question I will always ask adoptive parents, I'll say, what is the least thing you understood about adoption, you know, before you became an adoptive parent? And I'm not kidding, every group, whatever country, whatever state, they will always say, the level of grief and loss that my child has, we never understood it would be like that. And that's the piece people don't really want to acknowledge. They want the Disney.
Yeah, right. I mean, the children should be happy that they were adopted.
Should, yeah, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Zara Phillips. She's a singer, songwriter, author, and adoptee advocate, and she has written a book called Somebody's Daughter.
Well, Zara Phillips, in your book, Somebody's Daughter, you draw a correlation between being an adoptee and being an addict, or a connection between addiction and that. And can you clarify, what is the connection?
Well, the connection is that adoptees and foster people, children, adults, are overrepresented in treatment centers, institutions, I mean, prisons. And we know this. There are statistics. Adoptee teens are four times more likely to attempt suicide than their peers. And again, there are statistics around this. And yet still, and some organizations and treatment centers, you know, are beginning to go, oh, hold on a minute. How come every time, every month, we are our clients or our patients rather, there will always be a bunch of adoptees, always. And the same with one of the schools that I used to go to, which was in Woodstock, Connecticut. It was an amazing school. And they began to, it was a school for families, kids that are struggling. And they began to realize, hold on a minute, these families are adopted. And this is happening every year. We now need to focus on our adopted family and teens, which is when I was brought in to start doing these workshops with them. So some places get it. Some places still really don't. There is a trauma to being adopted, and there's no way around it. You know, people want to sort of, they say it's the only trauma in the world where the victim is told to be grateful.
If there's a large group of people, like you're giving a concert and you're looking out over the audience, do you think that there's a ton of adopted people? I mean, is it when you're looking at, say, people in the AA meeting, mm-hmm. there are more adoptees than you would statistically more than would be, say, at a grouping of people in your concert hall? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there are. And in treatment centers and in prisons and institutions, absolutely. One in four people are touched by adoption, know somebody's adopted. And also, you know, it's not just the adoptee, the birth mothers too. A lot of them, you know, can have issues around addiction too, because they have experienced such loss in their lives. You know, there's a real myth all around birth mothers that I could go into at another point, but we are overrepresented. And you know, it's not saying everybody that adopts a child, they're going to be an addict. Great if you're not, but I'm more interested in working with the families that are literally saying to me, we don't know what to do. Our child is, you know, attempted suicide already twice by the time they're 14. they're in and out of treatment, they're using drugs, they're sexually acting out. There is so many families suffering with their adopted teens, just going, well, how do, nobody told us this. What do we do?
You mentioned birth mothers. What about birth fathers? Are they similarly affected?
Well, the thing with birth fathers is many times birth fathers don't always know that they're birth fathers. Mm-hmm. So there's that whole thing. And, you know, some men don't want to take any responsibility. Yes, over the years, I have met birth fathers who have been devastated to learn that their girlfriend had a baby and gave it up for adoption, and they weren't even told. Devastated, you know, and wait years and search for their child because they want their child to know, we didn't abandon you. We had no say in the matter. So there are always those cases.
Well, in the United States now, there are increased restrictions on reproductive rights. How will this affect the world of adoptees and adoption?
Well, I have to tell you, there is an uprising going on within our community. And I'm very proud of all my adoptee peeps, because we have been silent for so long. You know, we don't want to be in the same sentence as an abortion. We don't want to be, it's a separate issue. You know, adoption is about parenting and abortion is about a woman's choice. And I'm always like, you know what? A woman has to make their choice. Yes, my birth mother thought of abortion through the whole pregnancy. That was hard to learn. And people will say to me, have said to me when I was a young girl, aren't you glad you weren't an abortion? Can you imagine as a kid? And you're like, what am I supposed to do with that? And I would say to you, yes, I feel lucky, but I don't feel, I no longer have to feel grateful. If that makes sense. Of course, I love life, I'm lucky, but we don't want to be a domestic supply of babies, which is what the Supreme Court has basically just said. We need more of a domestic supply of babies to fill these white privileged families void of not being able to have a baby. If, you know, a lot of our community, like, we're not puppies, that is not our role. Fill that need. So people are really mad, and there's a lot going on. There's a lot of activity right now around it. And in America, it is hugely money making. It's huge. Adoption, the adoption industry is vast, and we feel it. And international adoptees, they're actually having their first conference of saying, we are not, again, these, you know, little cute things to fill people's lives. They feel trafficked. I mean, it's a heavy word to say, but I'm learning so much more from my international adoptee peers. You know, it's complicated.
Well, a lot, about 20 years ago or so, I guess there was a lot of adoptees from
China.
All around the world, you know, Latin America as well. Is that because there was, less unwanted children in the United States, or why were there?
Well, the sad thing is, in foster care in America, there's a lot of children of color. There's so many, and even the price, even, you know, some of them are cheaper and more expensive depending on the shade of the child. I mean, it is absolutely barbaric. I've seen videos around it. And people don't want older children. They really believe if they have a baby, they can mold it. You know, they really can't, but that's what they think.
Yeah.
And also some adopted parents they're worried about birth parents. You know, you have somebody like Madonna and Angelina Jolie. Madonna has openly said, I don't want to deal with the birth parents showing up. So they, and I feel sad for the kids in foster care in America saying, why are the celebrities going out to another country to adopt? We're here. We need homes. So a lot of the time new babies are, we are the, you know, white babies. We are the top seller.
Did your mother and birth mother meet and have a relationship? No, they never met.
They never met. And I knew my birth mother over 20 years before my mum died. But amazingly, which I knew was a big deal, my mum died in 2008. And 4 months before she died, my birth mother said, "I'd really like to speak to your mother. Can you try again?" And I said to my mum, "Could you speak on the phone? You know, she'd like to phone you." And they spoke. And within moments, they both were calling me at the same time. You know, I got my adopted mum first, and the second I could see my birth mother like beeping through. And it was so funny. My adopted mother goes, she said, "Well, she was so nice. Well, she was very, she kept saying," and I said, "uneducated, common." And my mum went, "Well, yes." And I could tell my mother was relieved. Right. Ah. Her mind, she could at least say, I mean, you know, you have to also understand an adoptive mother who's infertile as a woman. That's a whole other thing we can talk about. Adoption really stems a lot, most of the time, from infertility. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are adoptive parents who've had biological children and they then adopt. But often it's from infertility. So you have a woman who's never dealt with the pain and loss of not being able to have her own baby. We are second choice. We kind of know that. So for her, it was just somehow she could be better than, you know. And also you're dealing with a younger woman, knowing most of our birth mothers were teens, and then our adoptive parent mothers know, you know, they're probably going to die and we're going to have time with our birth mothers. There's so many layers to this. Mm.
So I think there's sort of a pattern, again, generalizations, but so a couple will go through treatments trying to have children, and they spend a lot of money doing that, and then that fails, and then they adopt. So it's kind of a last resort kind of.
Well, you know, your second choice. I mean, you always know that as an adoptee. And mm-hmm. again, it's not saying that my mum didn't love me. And I know that adoptive parents will say, "No, it was meant to be. This child came into our lives. The moment we saw it, it was meant to be." But we know that you would have preferred to have your own baby first. Most, I'm not saying everybody, the majority of them. And that's normal. That's natural for a woman to want to have her own baby. And I find, though, for my mother, I knew she'd never really dealt with her grief. And the truth is, we don't look like our mothers. We're never going to look like our mothers.
There's so many layers of complexity here, but you're not saying that you're opposed to adoption. Adoption is a good thing.
No, I'm not saying adoption is a good thing.
You don't think adoption is a good thing?
No, I do not think adoption is a good thing. In very rare occasions, adoption is needed. The closed adoption system is really barbaric. In England, they're kind of more ahead. They will say it is kind of like emotional abuse. You know, to get a baby, put them with strangers, no story, you're given no story, and you're expected just to grow up and adapt. It's kind of like child abuse, actually. That's, again, sounds heavy, but I'm very radical. I've been doing this for years, and I've seen a lot. There is no need for so many adoptions. Teenage girls, they grow up. They don't stay teenagers forever. A lot of them just need support. 96% of birth mothers I know in America wanted reunion when the birth record started opening in states. 3 or 4% choose not to have reunion. So again, it's this whole myth of our parent mothers didn't want us. Not true. Most of them did. They didn't get the support they needed. Other countries, New Zealand, Australia, they adopt within the family. The most beneficial thing for a child, really, is all I care about, is that the child stays within the biological family. And if you look, and it does not happen in America, but if you look within the family, you will usually find a grandparent, a cousin, an aunt, somewhere where the child will stay. Doctors agree it is better for the child's mental health to stay within their biological family. I'm not saying they won't have issues about their mother not raising them, but less, you know, they have the biological connection. So for me, if there is to be adoption, open adoption, meaning you have a relationship, not just with You have a relationship with everybody. You want a baby, you have a relationship with that baby's mother and the baby. That is best for the child.
That would be a different situation. But if you've adopted a child from China or something, is that still possible?
No, sadly, it's not. But China is actually now closing the door because law has changed, where it was, you know, the one child policy has changed. But I have to tell you, the Chinese adoptees, they are desperately searching. They go to China, they go to villages, they put posters up, they do ancestry DNA. Siblings are being found within America. You know, there's a lot of stories out there where siblings find each other, which again shows the evidence. As human beings, we need our family. We will seek our family. And international adoptees are doing exactly the same thing. And they struggle, you know, honestly, the depths of despair of some of the stories, it just breaks my heart, because I will hear the adult adoptee or the young adoptee, you know, I wish that I had never been born. I feel so disconnected from myself. My country's rejected me. So they can have a hard time. But again, there are other adoptees who have a different resiliency and can get through.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Zara Phillips. She is a singer, songwriter, author, and adoptee advocate. Her book is called Somebody's Daughter, and her newest album is called Meditation and Kit Kats.
Zara Phillips, your book, Somebody's Daughter, is about all kinds of things. It's not just about being adopted. I mean, that's a theme that runs through the whole story, but you've also written a play that you perform. It's a one-woman show, is that right?
Yeah, well, I had a play about 7 years ago, which was on fathers, which was my relationship with my adopted dad and searching for my birth father. Mm-hmm. That was before I even thought I'd ever find my birth father. And then I found him. Then I wrote this book. And I wrote actually another book before this about a girl finding her father, because I thought I'm never going to find him. And my agent was like, great, you know, finish it. He started pitching it. And as he was pitching it, I said, you're never going to believe it. I found my father. So he was like, right, got to rewrite the whole thing. You're going to write another memoir. So, it's so the play, the new play, which I've never performed yet, I'm going to be performing at the end of August in London, is based on my book. But even from my book, the end of my book is not the end still. My story kept going. But I was like, I'm not writing another book about it. So the play will, you know, I'm going to share experiences from the book. And then there's even more, which I will not tell you, that happened in this crazy story that I have.
And so this will be, you have a plans to perform it or?
Yeah, I got into a festival in London called the Camden Fringe Festival. So I'm performing at the end of August, and Richard will actually be doing the live music, the incidental music. And it's more storytelling than my last play, but I will play both my mothers. And it is showing.
I want to see that.
Yes. And I'll do it in the States too. But it is showing, I'm telling the story of meeting my birth mother and finally finding my birth father 26 years later, these two reunions. And I want to show recovery. I want to show, hopefully, this is what I'm doing, hopefully it will come across, that we can stay sober no matter what. As addicts, we can stay sober, even when life throws really complicated things. So I'm hoping it reaches that audience too, of anybody that struggled with addiction. You know, I was sober young. You know, I've managed to maintain long time sobriety, not perfectly by any means.
Yeah.
But
well, that must be especially hard. Now, you mentioned Richard, and Richard is Richard Thompson, the musician. He's been a guest here on From the Bookshelf. He just wrote a wonderful memoir called Bee's Wing, and he was with the band Fairport Convention and been a solo star. And he's your husband.
Yeah, we just got married in November.
Congratulations.
Right. You see, you never know what's going to happen in life.
And so is it living a rock and roll lifestyle must make it particularly difficult to stay sober?
Oh, no. I mean, I was a singer way before I ever met Richard. You know, right. I started in my 20s and I toured with bands and all of that. And that's when I was actively using and drinking and Mad Men and all the stuff, you know, crazy stuff. Working with, and then I had a break. I mean, I kept doing my music, but I had a break from that sort of those situations, shall we say. And then I had my kids and had a break from it. But working with Richard and the folk scene, I mean, we laugh. It is so different. Yeah. You know, the folk scene, it's just not, you know, I'll say to him, but how could you have been around all of this? You know, I mean, I have experienced more madness in my life than he has because they just, it's just different. It's just not throwing TVs out the window. The folk people just don't do that.
They don't. No.
Okay. They're more polite. You know, they get drunk. Of course they get drunk. But you know, Richard doesn't drink either, which is great. You know, so it's not even an issue for us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your singing career and your most recent CD, which I love, Meditations and Kit Kats.
Well, Meditation and Kit Kats, I have to tell you the title.
Yeah.
Was I was thinking a lot about long-term recovery. And if somebody said to me, how have you stayed sober? How all these years, how have you done it? I would say, what are the two things that have helped me? Meditation and eating Kit Kats. And actually I bought Kit Kats. I just bought some in Norway. I've been buying Kit Kats from all different countries.
Well, then my next question would be, how do you stay so slender?
I think genetic luck. Another thing, I found my biological family, my birth mother was slim, my birth father, it's just fantastic. Things like that, whereas my adopted mother was always on a diet and I could literally eat anything I wanted and everybody was mad with me, you know, no, it's not my fault. And it really is genetic luck, but I love that I can be with my biological family and nobody says to me, how come you're so slender? Because they're all slender too. It's great.
Well, you've made a music video in which you play Bob Dylan, sort of.
Yes.
And with Richard Thompson and also Warren Zanes, another person who's been a guest on my show here. Who's
all right. Terrific. Yeah, we love Warren.
And I want to play a track from your album. Which song should we play? And tell us a little bit about that song.
I think if we're on the theme of a song that I am going to use in my play is Perfect Stranger. I think it's the first track. Okay. And I think that's just of, you know, you meet family and we are strangers. And how, I don't know, I just love that line, you know. I love that line.
Nobody's perfect.
Perfect stranger. Nobody's perfect. But in those situations, you act perfect because you don't want to be in any way rejected. So you will be that perfect stranger of whatever it takes to be, you know, accepted into the family.
And there's some harmony vocals on this. Are you singing your own harmony vocal?
I am on some of the tracks. On this, my daughter actually sang. And I can't remember, I think Richard might on this track as well. Maybe it's him and my daughter, which was lovely to and have.
How old is your daughter and what is her name?
I have three. So I have Zach, who's 26, Kayla, who's turning 22, and Arden, who sang, who's turning 20. She's at Berklee School of Music in Boston. So I thought, you know what, why would I hire somebody else to get my kid in? I had to pay her.
And so she's a musician. What form does it take for
her? She was doing voice and now she's very interested in doing sort of more programming and film for music for film. So it's kind of just changing. She's been there a couple of years, but I think she has a lovely voice, way better than me. Both my girls sing beautifully.
So do you. Let's hear this track. So this is from the album Meditation and Kit Kats. And it's Zara Phillips and Perfect Strangers.
I can change colors like a chameleon, blue and umber and grey. I'll bend and I'll shape the way that you want me, and maybe I'll get to stay. I feel like I'm just an imposter living here with you. I feel like the perfect stranger living in your oh-so-perfect world. I feel like the perfect stranger pretending to be that girl. I fell from a cloud, look where I landed, always dancing with danger. Running and falling, shaking and breaking, dancing from stranger to stranger. Why do I have to pay the price for crimes I didn't do? I feel like the perfect stranger living in your oh-so-perfect world. I feel like the perfect stranger pretending to be that girl. I can never be what you want me to be. Tell me, what else can I do? I feel like the perfect stranger living in your oh-so-perfect world. I feel like the perfect stranger pretending to be that girl. World. I feel like the perfect stranger pretending to be that girl.
And that was Zara Phillips singing Perfect Strangers. She's my guest, and she has a fantastic book that you should check out. It's called Somebody's Daughter, and she'll also be performing soon. Where will you be performing your play again?
In London, in Highgate, upstairs at the Gate. But they can go to my website, zaraphillips.net, for information.
And you're touring currently with Richard Thompson. Will you be in the United States?
We're in Europe this summer because all the work from COVID that didn't happen for 2 years, everything is literally happening this year. So we're going to be going on some river cruises, two river cruises, amazing, and some gigs in various countries, which I don't remember, and a bunch of stuff in the UK. And then he does Cropperdy, which is the Fairport Convention Festival in August. And then I'm talking, doing my play. So,
have you done cruises before?
I went with him on a cruise just a couple of months ago, but I've never done a river cruise. The river cruise is going down the Rhine, and then there's one in Amsterdam. Wow. Yeah, it sounds amazing.
Oh, I hope that's fun.
It'd be really fun.
Well, Zara Phillips, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. The book, again, is called Somebody's Daughter, and the album is called Meditation and Kit Kats. Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.